Mornings with Virginia Trioli.
Your chance to kick back, relax, and just enjoy some great conversations this morning. A cast of thousands coming through the studio, kicked off this morning by Stephen Mayne, shareholder, activist, and founder of crikey.com.au. Stephen, good morning.
Hello, Virginia. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's great just to sort of have a morning of doing very little apart from just chatting.
Yes, you've got to hope the Sydney Harbour bridge doesn't collapse or something like that.
Please don't even wish that, although we will be there on the spot if that's the case. Look at this beautiful blue day. It's a gorgeous day. Finally, we've gotten out of this gloomy grey weather. 16 degrees outside right now, Bankstown 17, Campbelltown 16, Gosford 14, Katoomba 8. It's been a hell of a year, though, hasn't it, Stephen, when it comes to business news? And we've just been hearing is this the completion now of the Wall Street Journal buyout by Rupert Murdoch?
That's right. 60% of shareholders approved it overnight. So Australia's most famous businessman has literally a couple of hours ago just cemented the world's most famous paper. So it's quite a big day.
It's a hell of an achievement. It didn't look that possible to begin with, did it? I mean, you're dealing here with, you know, an old family, a sort of a bastion of American journalism and publishing history. The assumption was that the inherent conservatism over there would immediately reject a Murdoch-type bid.
Yeah, well, look, Rupert's been a master at breaking into countries and establishments that wouldn't have him.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, he can't go better than this. I mean, this is, you know, as American as apple pie buying Dow Jones. So for one little guy, you know, born in Melbourne, his father started out as a suburban reporter on The Age in Melbourne back in 1903 to look at that journey and particularly his 55 years since his father died in October 1952. It's a heck of a journey. And I always look back at those formative years he had in Sydney, actually, when he first came here from Adelaide in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, and embarked on a massive tabloid war with the Fairfax, you know, and the Packers, the establishment Sydney
That's
families.
Right,
yes. And he was the outsider then who cracked it in Australia's biggest city, learnt the running of competitive newspapers and basically learnt all the tabloid tricks in particular, took those skills to London, transformed the London Sun into the world's biggest selling and most famous tabloid, and then now finally has parlayed that into owning the world's most prestigious business title. So phenomenal story.
It is really phenomenal, and it's an amazing, just great bunch of content, isn't it, that he now gets to play with, particularly for the Australian newspaper. That's a great connection there of content that's got to be scaring the heck out of Fairfax, surely.
Oh, look, I think you'd be very nervous if you were Fairfax. But I think it's interesting that he's not going to launch an Australian version of the Wall Street Journal. He's just going to pump the journal's content into the Australian.
Yeah.
I think really the biggest story is the internet phenomenon, that the Wall Street Journal is the one successful paid model in the world where, you know, that they're making more than $100 million a year from subscription revenue to their internet site. And Rupert looks like he's going to make that free. So he's just going to say, no, it's all free. You can all have it for nothing. And the advertising will pay for it. So that will be, you know, and as well as buying MySpace and getting into the whole social networking side of things, he has, you know, gone from being the world's most famous newspaper proprietor to being at the cutting edge of the whole internet dynamic in terms of news.
You're missing a very big personal event for you today, Stephen Mayne, for reasons known only to yourself and despite my many years of discouragement at your, it seems to me, quixotic attempts to try and run for public office. You stood against Peter Costello in the seat of Higgins, attempting to win a seat in federal parliament. I never know with you whether it's delusions of grandeur or just the usual gadfly behaviour for which you are well known, but surprise, surprise, you didn't win it, did you?
No, Virginia, I have to say the final figures are in. I was at 1.98%.
1.98%? Does that get you anything? No.
No, it gets you nothing. You need 4% to make any money.
How much money do you lose then on
that? Oh, well, I spent $5,000. So I've dropped $5,000 on that.
Can you claim that on tax?
I think I can because I'm a professional candidate. I mean, that's what I do. I run for boards. I've run 35 times for different things.
So my tax
return says candidate. A journalist, activist, candidate.
And the tax office accepts that.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I do. It's immersion journalism. You participate in things and write about the experience. That's what I do.
That's hilarious.
So, yes, but this morning you're denying me a chance to be at the declaration of the poll. So 2 hours after I agreed to set the alarm for 4:30 a.m. and fly up here to talk to you from Melbourne,
I got the
email from the Electoral Commission. Come on down to Malvern for the declaration of the poll at 10 a.m. on Friday. So And I've got my a couple of my staff are going along with a camera to present the treasurer, or the former treasurer, with a letter just requesting when the timing of the by-election. So, you know, if you can make it a date that actually suits
to
fit in with the AGM seasons coming up and stuff like that.
Because you'll stand again.
Well, actually, I probably won't, but I'm just having a bit of fun with him. And,
thank goodness for that.
And send him a letter. No, I think you can only run once in against Peter Costello, particularly when he's gone.
Do you reckon he is going? Do you reckon there will be a by-election and that he won't be recruited into the leadership?
Oh, I think for sure. He's going onto the board scene, you know, professional director, you know, he's going to make some millions.
He left that option open in the end.
No, I think it's pretty clear cut that he's going. I think what is interesting is whether they do like an orchestrated four or five by-elections on the one day. So, you know, if Philip Ruddock and, I mean, there's even talk maybe of Kevin Andrews, you know, Alexander Down, a range of them are going to go at some point. And whether the Liberals run the four by-elections.
Is that your moment? You've got to answer it on air now. That's the rule. Answer it on air.
No. I'm sorry about that. I can't answer that. I'll turn it off. Gee, rule 1A. I mean, I can't believe I've done that.
Yeah,
I've actually filled in your equivalent position in Melbourne for a few shifts.
Classic.
And I've learned that lesson.
Absolutely classic. Who was it?
I didn't say. Someone from Melbourne, doesn't matter.
Turn it off, please. No, 21 minutes tonight on 702 ABC Sydney. They never learn. Stephen Mayne is with you, and a cast of thousands coming through the studio this morning to chat about the year in review and also any stories that are running this morning too. I think one really interesting aspect that we've got to kick around in many different ways this morning, Stephen Mayne, is the UN Climate Change Conference, Al Gore's late arrival, and whether that's going to sort of, you know, kick the discussions up a notch. But it's been really interesting, I'm sure, from your particular perspective, to see that it has actually been the world of commerce, it's been the world of business that's been most ahead of the curve when it comes to understanding how crucial this issue is, how to deal with it, and also, of course, how to make money from it.
Well, I think that's right, that particularly in Australia and the US, the business world has been absolutely ahead of the curve. And I think in Australia it was a case of Nicholas Stern's report for the British government really did scare the bejesus out of the business community here, such that they were calling for a lot of action, you know, well ahead of John Howard.
But which is really odd, because just to jump in there, so the business community read it and went, heck, you know, we have to deal with this, and also we need to stay financially viable, so we've got to figure out ways of turning this to our advantage. Even while there was still argument raging on in various commentary circles and also political circles about whether to even believe the report. Why did business immediately decide to believe the report when others didn't?
I think that the business is more inclined to look at fact-based decision-making. And I think that was the bottom line, was that the science was actually becoming so clear-cut that a lot of business guys are actually very thorough and empirical. And whereas the politicians were used to the old paradigm of, I mean, look at John Howard and George Bush, it's just greenies and greenhouse issues, that's the left, they're our opponents.
Yep.
So it's in their DNA to basically say, you know, I can't possibly agree with the Greens and the left, therefore I'm going to hold the line on that.
Mm.
And so many of the business community were actually further advanced. So, I mean, it will be very interesting to see how it all plays out from here, and whether Gore and everyone else can actually get George Bush over the line, and how important George Bush losing Australia as an ally, as the other major industrialised holdout nation, whether the isolation that the US now faces actually has an impact, and whether, you know, there is a Malcolm Turnbull within the White House, within the Bush camp, which says, well, maybe that late adoption is something that will look better for the legacy. Because I think that people will look back at John Howard's legacy, and I think the whole climate change thing will be a big black mark against him.
How do you rate how Kevin Rudd has been handling himself over in Bali?
Well, I think, everyone knew that he was going to be cautious. And I think, obviously the NGOs and the Greenpeaces and everyone who were there who were just dominating the media. I mean, it's amazing how influential they have been over the debate in terms of actually influencing the journalists and putting pressure on the Australian delegation to actually, you know, lock into binding emission cuts by 2020. And I think Rudd was always going to wait for Ross Garnaut's report. He was always going to be the paper-shuffling bureaucrat who looks at the reports, who gets the advice, who makes the careful decision. And so many Australians, particularly of the progressive left, were so keen to see just an instant, we are now leading the charge, we're absolutely at the front of the push to lock in for emissions. And people forget that we are the world's biggest emitters per capita. We have massive reliance on the coal industry, the aluminium industry and the iron ore industry. I mean, at the end of the day, it's coal and iron ore exports, which, if you are to identify the specific heart and soul of this boom in Australia, it's that. It's coal and iron ore exports, New South Wales, Queensland, WA. And to really leap, you know, headlong into the deep end of binding cuts, you know, 40% cuts by 2020.
It cuts that prosperity dead, or cuts you are it over the knees.
Well, you are talking, you know, that's the end of New South Wales and coal, you know, new coal-fired plants. You know, New South Wales needs new baseload power.
Yeah.
It naturally would be coal, because you've got, you know, the Hunter Valley and this absolute abundance of coal. But to go 40% cuts instantly by 2020, and you have to look at the most carbon-intensive power, and that is coal. So that they get pretty tough decisions, and, you know, you look at Maurice Yemma's trying to raise $15 billion selling up his power stations. And
but hang on, but that brings us back to the beginning of this conversation. That's where business comes in. So presumably business or elements of it identifies the opportunity and says, fine, then carbon emission sequestration is going to have to be the logical outcome of if we're going to build new or stay with the old. Don't we, I mean, you're a believer in the free market and in the market providing the solutions. Don't we agree to the cuts and have an ongoing sense of faith and trust that the market will deliver the solutions to that particular problem?
Well, the market
will... They'll be able to make money from it.
The market will deliver it, but equally it's going to need, I mean, so much pioneering research, technological development does need a big government kickstart, and it does need huge amounts of government funding to really give the incentive for billions to be spent on the carbon capture and storage sequestration.
Well, the federal government's got the cash for that.
That's right, yeah. So that's where you really need the leadership. I mean, I think the argument you're making is the market and human ingenuity is that it basically will get together and come up with a solution. But, I mean, carbon capture and storage, and given the scale of emissions from, you know, from cars and airlines and power stations, it's so huge, and the cuts are so massive. And
I don't know quite where the underground space.
I know, and we're all on this massive growth train. I mean, China. I mean, the growth out of China, that is just a, you know, a carbon producing machine. And how are you going to stop that juggernaut? And how are you going to lock in the Chinese to basically telling hundreds of millions of you know, farmers in China that your growth desires are going to be constrained by the fact that, you know, you're producing too much carbon by using all this Australian iron ore and coal, which is sort of a pretty crude way of describing it. But this is the greatest challenge I've ever seen. And just the idea of governments all getting together and multilaterally working up a solution where there's going to be a lot of pain and a lot of increases in power prices and a lot of technology and a lot of government spend and a lot of dislocation. It's a great test for that human ingenuity and the ability of the world to get on.
14 minutes to 9 on 702 ABC Sydney. Stephen Mayne is with you, as am I, Virginia Trioli, until 11 o'clock. Now, look, don't just sit there at home yelling at the radio saying, but what about this, but what about that? Get on the phone, 1-300-222-702, because it's just a big catch-up today. It's our year in review. It's all the topics under discussion, and I know how strong your opinions are on this stuff. So it's open line right through the morning, really, 1-300-222-702. Martin's called in. G'day.
Hello, how are you, Virginia?
Well, thank you.
I actually emailed you yesterday. Thank you, goodbye, good luck.
Thank you.
But apart from that, Stephen Mayne was just talking about baseload, and everybody seems to say, when they say baseload, it equals coal or gas. I was in New Zealand a week ago. New Zealand has a target overall for getting to 90% renewable energy in its generation, and all new baseload power stations are going to be renewable. Don't ask me what the technology is, but all new baseload will be renewable.
How are you going to do that exactly, though, Stephen?
Massive hydro or a heck of a lot of wind farms. So New Zealand have got more capacity for hydro, so there is potentially a hydro solution there. But Australia, you know, the Kevin Rudd's goal is 20% renewable by 2020. That is pretty ambitious. And that will comprise about 10% wind, and then solar and hydro come in there as well. But baseload, at the end of the day, to deal with the air conditioning peak at the top end of a hot Sydney day, you can't rely on wind. The lights will go out. I mean, you have to have base load, either gas or coal or nuclear. I mean, I think it's a really interesting test for the Labor Party that I think John Howard was right, that if you're serious about carbon, then nuclear is the other base load that you've got to get into, and you don't want to spend 3 hours debating that one because it gets pretty hot.
Stephen, go away immediately. Nice to hear from you. Thanks so much for calling in, Martin. Thank you. Good on you. And Paul is ringing in now. G'day, Paul.
G'day. Hi. Virginia, I'm quite a big fan of what you both do in the media.
Thank you.
Listen, Stephen, I was just curious, as I've read about half the Stern Review and ran through it. I'm actually in the mining industry, so I have a couple of bones in the closet. And, the way that you speak of it, that it's going to be quite a big challenge, and that, well, you know, to cut all these emissions is going to have to be hard by 2020. Pretty much, I think, if we don't act very severely on it now, aren't you of the opinion after running through the Stern Review that we're going to be pretty much stuffed?
I am.
2040,
yeah.
2050?
I completely agree. I was making the point that the Stern Review scared the bejesus out of the business community because it was such a credible, you know, it was a British government commissioned report which came out with incredibly scary forecasts of the economic damage. And that's when the business community sat up. And for mine, I thought, you know, having people like, you know, Howard Cheer Squad types like Andrew Bolt, you know, on the ABC describing Stern as a, quote, a fraud.
Yes.
I thought that was very, you know, an example of the sort of the head in the sand approach we saw in Australia when business took Stern seriously, but a lot of the, you know, Howard himself and his supporters just tried to say nut and dismiss it. I think you have to read Stern and take it very seriously.
Yeah, well, it's quite interesting that the Howard government aligned itself so closely with the invasion of Iraq, yet when it came to something that was commissioned by the British government, by Her Majesty's Royal Government, that they then tend to go, well, sorry, we don't believe in this.
Yeah, well, that's politics, I guess. You take what you most want to hear and you reject what you don't agree with. 9:10 on 702 ABC Sydney. You and I have spent a long time together having quite a few chats over the years, Stephen Mayne. I mean, it goes back about 8 years by my count.
I think that's right. I think Valentine's Day 2000, February 14, 2000.
There's no connection there, is
there? No, there's not. That was the day I launched Crikey, actually, and I think I had my first chat with you that day. So, yes, it's been a heck of a lot of water under the bridge and an awful lot of interesting business stories over the years. So I must say, looking back at this year and the big business stories, I still marvel at the Qantas deal. And even just all the papers today are full of Qantas profit upgrade, another shock profit upgrade. And I have to, I'll tell you a little secret here, actually. I'm actually pushing hard to actually be the plaintiff on a class action against Qantas. I'm talking to a couple of these sort of ambulance chasing types and stuff, because it's quite outrageous
what
happened.
What's the nature of the class action?
Well, they urged all their shareholders to sell their shares into the takeover. And if you look at the figures, the takeover bid, the $11 billion takeover bid closed in early May of this year. And they were forecasting a profit at the time of $942 million. So they said, sell your shares because we're only going to make $942 million this year pre-tax. Mm. 10 weeks later, they announced a profit $140 million higher than that, $1,079 million. And now today, or yesterday, they've come out with their latest profit upgrade, their fifth in the last year, saying they're now going to make, you know, $1.4 billion pre-tax. So basically, the shareholders, and I was one of them, I sold my shares in March of this year after hearing the urgings that we should all sell because the share price will tank because it's just this is a great takeover offer.
Yeah.
So I think this is the no-brainer class action. I'm just trying to get a law firm or two to actually back it because I've never seen a board so outrageously say, sell, sell, sell based on these figures. And, oh, sorry, the figures are all wrong. We're actually making much more than we said we were.
So what do you want? You want the value of your shares back that you sold?
Well, everyone like me, I sold at $5.30. Everyone like me who sold out there. Now, the shares cracked $6 yesterday. We've lost profit. And we've basically followed the board's advice and we've lost profit. And shareholder class actions are a growing thing. And I just think this is a no-brainer. And I suspect it'll probably happen at some point in the next couple of months.
Stephen Mayne is with you. It's 9:08 on 702 ABC Sydney. And another guest joining you in the studio in just a moment. She's well known to you. She's one of the voices of the Spin Doctors.
Grandstand Summer of Cricket.
Grandstand Summer of Cricket.
Cricket's on the radio.
Fresh from the 2020 showdown, Australia will be out to regain the Chapel Hadley Trophy. The Black Caps won convincingly in New Zealand and face a reinvigorated, full-strength Australian team.
Cricket's on the radio.
The first of three matches, the Chappell Hadley Trophy, today from the Adelaide Oval.
Here on 702 ABC Sydney.
We've got it covered.
It is warming up outside. It's 20 degrees right now and 19 in Bankstown, 17 in Campbelltown, a top of 25 on the coast expected today. Stephen Mayne and I are now joined by Sue Cato, Principal of Cato Council. Sue, good morning.
Good morning, Virginia. Good morning, Stephen.
Morning, Cato.
Good, good to have you both on board. Look, another big news story of the day, of course, and we're hotly anticipating, aren't we, the extracts that appear to have been purchased by the Fairfax newspaper group of Margot Savile's book, which is on Maxine McHugh's win, her giant slaying effort in the seat of Benelong. And there's some early interviews with Maxine McHugh now. She's been very, very careful in not playing the main media. Her entire campaign was a local campaign. So that's going to be absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
Well, you know, Maxine actually understood where the effort had to be, you know, put in, and that was with the electors. I mean, it didn't matter if people in, you know, Udna Dada thought she was fantastic, they weren't voters. So, I mean, she was very much talking to her local papers. But what is interesting about this book, I think, is how quickly it's come out. It's fresh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's news. You're not going back and looking at something like what happened last year, because most of these books take that long time. So the fact that these people were talking to Margot, and Margot's a very interesting journo that most of us know, the fact that people were talking to Margot at a time when, quite frankly, the election outcome was unknown. So they were going on the record before this sort of stuff was known. So, yeah, pretty interesting read.
There's a bit of background there as well, which might be of use to you, because it's published, I think, by Melbourne University Press, and Louise Adler, the publisher there, is also the one who got hold of Mark Latham's diaries. So she's interested in politics. She moves quickly, and for those who know her, she's, you know, devilishly persuasive. She's almost impossible to say no to. So a bit of a publishing coup, Stephen.
I think so. And it's always interesting that Labor books do always sell better than Liberal books. So, I mean, you know, for the 11 years of the Howard government, there were so few John Howard. I mean, the John Howard biography came out in the last year. There was David Barnett's biography. But there really were, you know, there hasn't been Philip Ruddock, the biography, or, I mean, they just
probably
don't
shouldn't
sell.
I've known Philip for a very long time, but probably...
You're still prepared to say that?
Well, yeah, no, but absolutely. I think, you know, got to be straight on these things. And all I'll say is that some of the Labor stories make better reads, if I could put it that way.
Yeah.
They're better reads.
And Mungo, rollicking yarns.
I think Mungo's got it. Mungo McCallum's got a book on the election as well.
Yeah, look, I've actually just received that. I've not had a chance to have a look at it, but that's another quickie too. But Mungo, I guess, is sort of like off. I don't want to be unkind here, but he's out of the mainstream. And he lives
in Byron Bay.
That's not what I'm
Byron
saying.
Byron Bay.
No, it's a slightly more eccentric political view. Is that the
yes,
way of putting it?
Yes, I think you could say it's fairly polemical, I think you'd say, the book. It's,
You've had a look at it?
Oh, well, I've seen some extracts, and, it's belting a man who's just lost, I think, is a fair way to describe it.
There's going to be a lot of that, though, Sue.
Well, it's really interesting to me. I think someone who's got off really lightly this year is actually Peter Costello.
Not for trying by Stephen May.
I know, but I mean, Stephen, you know, let's have a yarn about it. I mean, I'm not out here to sort of beat people up who have lost, but, you know, politics is a tough game. If you want the leadership, you take it. Now, I've got to say, there were precedents, quite frankly. Andrew Peacock, when he took the leadership from Howard, didn't want to take it. He wanted it to be delivered to him on a platter, that the numbers were already there, and that he was just, you know, anointed and sort of wished into the job, if you like. But it's a quaint notion, and quite frankly, I don't think it's acceptable.
I think it's a really interesting issue. I think the Liberal Party's treated him very badly. But I also think that Alexander Downer's off-the-record comments at the press club about, you know, the Costello supporters were frankly rude, and this caused the PM to dig in. I actually reckon that's right. And that if Costello had sat there and not agitated and had been, you know, the perfect loyal deputy, that he would have actually probably got a handover.
Hang on. Politics is tough. Howard's guys have been pretty brutal. I mean, you and I have both been, you know, we mix with both sides. And there's
But that was Downer's comment. Downer's comment was Howard would have handed over if Costello hadn't been such an impetulant spoiled sport and doing all this briefing behind the scenes.
And brought up the note in the wallet.
Well, all that stuff, the note and the warrant, all of the Athens Declaration, the constant briefings and leakings going on by his...
Yeah, but it still sounds a bit prissy, if you ask me.
It's such a Sydney thing to oh, you've got to blast him out. You know, the whole Keating approach.
Oh, hang on,
if you don't
hang
want
on.
The prize, you've got to blast him out.
Hang on, I'm sitting beside Stephen Mayne, and he's telling me it's a Sydney thing to blast people about things.
Sydney is such a rough town. In Melbourne, Costello is Melbourne blue blood, and he basically said, I'm not going to blow up my party, I'm not going to be destructive and challenge.
Okay. But, Stephen, but name a political leader who has not had to be blasted out of office.
But
come
also,
on.
Let's talk about what's the party looking like now, though.
And that's Howard's fault. Look
no,
what he's,
it's both their faults. Quite frankly, you've got every single state machine absolutely in tatters. You've got no party memberships probably at the lowest that I can remember in my 20 years history.
None worse than New South Wales.
No,
Howard's
I agree.
Faction.
Not Howard's faction. This is the really... I know it, Stephen, we're not disagreeing as fundamentally as this might sound. The right are not run by Howard. The right are run by the right here. Howard happens to surf with them and take a lot of... support from these guys, but they are their own animal.
I look at for instance, Bill Heffernan's attack on Justice Michael Kirby, which was absolutely outrageous. And I think in these things, the fish starts
rotting.
I'm going
to get another phone call from Bill Heffernan now.
Well, you are, yeah. But
good morning, Bill Heffernan.
That's his going away gift from Stephen May.
The fish rots from the head. And I think it was things like that where Howard tolerated that. He tolerated Heffernan doing that. He didn't just cut him down. And that's where things like that in New South Wales, in his own faction, where he didn't set the tone and set the standard.
I suppose this is where I'm saying Howard's guys and Howard's supporters were just as tough and played just as hard a game as any of Costello's people do. I mean, it's politics. It's a tough, ugly game.
Well, you know this from the leadership takeovers and transitions, yep. You know, that you've been involved in your career, particularly with the Liberals.
It's brutal. I mean, you heard the last night, you know, on ABC, we were hearing about, you know, members of the right faction who were basically blowing a raspberry to Andrew Robb. Mm. And quite frankly, in some ways, and, you know, Robb's obviously also involved in some of all of this stuff in Victoria, but in some ways I'd actually like to see Andrew Robb as state party, as federal president of the Liberal Party, because he's the only one right now who's really calling it as it is.
On the Bennelong issue, Mary, good morning, Mary, who lives in Bennelong, wants us to note the point that it was the Greens that got Maxine over the line in her seat, and we should not forget that.
Well, they got 6%, I think, wasn't it? So their preferences did get them over the line technically, but, you know, I think it was someone called Maxine.
Yeah, and a rather remarkable attempt. We might read out a few of those little excerpts or excerpts from the interview that Maxine McHugh's been giving at some time this morning, and lots more regulars and guests on the morning program joining you throughout this morning. Can you both stay for a little bit longer? Because I'm quite enjoying the stash.
Sure,
it's
happy
quite
to.
Fun.
Sue Kato's sort of having her morning exercise, Stephen. This is how she gets
no,
going
just
for the
I
day.
I don't get to be with Stephen. We just get to chat and do other things.
That's right. Sue Kato is with you, Principal of Kato Council, and Stephen Mayne as well. News time now on 702 ABC Sydney. It's 9 o'clock.
Mornings with Virginia Trioli on 702 ABC Sydney.
John, thank you very much. 20 degrees outside, Bankstown 19, Campbelltown 17, Gosford 18, Katoomba 11, Penrith 17 and Richmond 17 degrees. It's a celebrity roast this morning, you might say, on the morning program. Joining you in the studio, Stephen Mayne, shareholder activist Sue Kato, principal with Kato Council, one of our spin doctors. Joining them, John Brown, one of our party liners, former ALP Federal Minister for Tourism. Mr. Brown, good morning.
Good morning, Virginia.
You're looking very
Hello,
well.
Hello, your millions of listeners.
Tens and tens and tens, hundreds of thousands, actually. More circulation than a newspaper.
Virginia, he's a poly, always a poly, never an ex, always never an ex-poly. And what's the difference between a couple of hundred thousand and a mil? That's what
well,
I say.
She's going out with the same ratings as John Laws. That's not bad.
Oh, that'll do.
Yeah.
I'll take
there
that.
There you go.
Of course, she's a better sort.
He really is being a suck this morning, isn't it? We'll give you a hard time in just a moment.
That wouldn't make you the world's most beautiful woman. Let me tell you, a better sort than Lawsy.
Nice. But of course she is
nicely
the world's
recovered.
Most beautiful woman, Brownie.
Beg pardon?
She is, of course, the world's most beautiful woman. That's where you were heading, though,
you were
it?
Heading that.
Absolutely
yeah.
correct.
Yeah. A motorcycle accident on Eastern Creek, and probably a couple to happen in here as well, on the M4 motorway just past Walgrove Road. That's eastbound. Car accident to a Parramatta O'Connell Street at Grove Street. Car breakdown at Arncliff. Marsh Street at Flora Street. That's blocking an eastbound lane. Car accident at Belmont, the Pacific Highway at Red Rose Avenue, and that's affecting southbound traffic. John Brown, your primary overwhelming interest, of course, is politics, state and federal. You pay close attention to it here in New South Wales, but what an amazing story federally. Have you stopped celebrating yet, the Kevin Rudd win?
No. And why shouldn't I? Why should I? I mean, I think that it was a huge step forward for Australia to get back to decent government. I don't care which party's in power, as long as we've got good government. And I thought we had very
bad
government.
You don't care. You're a Labor minister. Of course you care. You've been celebrating for
well,
2 weeks now.
I'll rephrase it. I don't care which sort of Labor party. I mean, they've got Ku-ring-gai Council left, and they've got Brisbane City Council left, but the mayor gets knocked off in March anyhow, so...
You reckon he'll get knocked off there?
Well, you know how he
could...
It's a majority of Labor aldermen to begin with, but yeah. Beattie insisted on this fellow that they put up as a candidate, and the aldermen wouldn't vote for him.
Ronnie, you've just got to enjoy the moment.
Enjoy the moment. The moment's going to go on for about 20 years, Sue.
Do you like Kevin Rudd?
Yeah, I do. He's a really nice young man. The reason I know him very well, because my flatmate in Canberra for 13 years was Ben Humphreys, who was a member for Griffiths and a former... Minister for Veterans Affairs, although I used to refer to him as the Veteran Minister for Affairs, but that's another story. And it's not true, Beryl. It was not true. It's a myth.
It's just a gag.
So I knew him very well. And he's a really nice, intelligent, cultured young man, yes.
He's not very Sydney, though. I mean, you're from the rough and tumble of the New South Wales, right? All the colourful characters of Sydney, larger-than-life figures. And
Stephen, that's your first mistake. I'm not part of the Sydney right at all.
But you're part of that.
The right opposed me for pre-selection.
But you're part of that colourful Sydney political scene. And Kevin Rudd's he's a bit bookish for the Sydney political type.
He doesn't go to footy.
Hang on, guys. Let's talk about the New South Wales right for a little while. Their obsession with American politics, their obsession, or I should say at least the ex-premier Bob Carr's obsession with Roman Empire, etc. These boys are the biggest bookheads in the country.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, all this nonsense that I saw promulgated through the election period about his front bench being loaded with ex-union officials.
Mm. Well, it is.
Why didn't someone illustrate the number of university degrees they hold, including one with a Master of Business Administration?
All highly educated, no doubt. But Bill Shorten's got an MBA. But I think you'll see less of that. I mean, it is ridiculous that one sectional interest has majority... professional background for a federal cabinet, and I think you'll see it fall.
Wait a minute. I went through the Fraser cabinet when I was in opposition. 18 solicitors or lawyers, 8 farmers, and some of the farmers were lawyers as well, and one who wasn't. They gave him the appellation of being a Catholic. That was Phil Lynch. That's how they could distinguish him.
The other issue you've got is if you go actually through the Liberals, and you know, as everyone in this room knows, I spent the wayward years of my early youth involved with as a Liberal staffer.
Thank God
you
grew up.
No, Sukato, more than that, you actually marshalled young Liberal stormtroopers.
I'd prefer not to call them stormtroopers.
Ruddock was a stormtrooper, wasn't he?
They were called the Hit Squad.
The Hit
Squad, and they did unfortunately have. Shirts that I had specially made for them, and there were about 100 of them. And unfortunately, on one occasion,
they did rise.
They were polo shirts, actually, much more elegant, as you would expect for young Liberals. And unfortunately, they did rise to the Labor bait on one occasion. Some Labor students, and unfortunately, did take Hit Squad a little too literally, which is a slight problem. But
they're not as good these days, Kate. I mean, you know, look at Lindsay. I mean, you know, back in your day, I mean, you knew how to do. Proper political sort of espionage sort of stuff.
When he's saying you, he's actually meaning, you know, the party, of course. I mean, it wouldn't be person specific there at all.
Of course not. I want to bring up a topic that's been raised by a listener. I received an email this morning. I think it was following our discussion the other day, Stephen Mayne, about business in Sydney, PPPs and the like. Name one PPP that's worked in Sydney.
Cross City Tunnel.
Define worked in terms of
spectacular deal for the taxpayers. You've got a road, it works,
cars
people use it, cars go through it, you drive here every day on it, Virginia, and
hasn't cost you anything.
Cost me a bomb.
That's the only one that has worked.
The toll, yeah. John Brown, would you agree?
Well, no, look, anybody who gets into a commercial enterprise takes a risk. I remember back in the 80s encouraging Japanese to come in and build hotels. They built them willy-nilly all over the place.
Yeah, they were very successful, well done.
They said, you bugger, Brownie. I said, well, they can't take the bricks and mortar home with them.
Brownie, you were an absolute legend. Brownie got the Japanese in. They dropped 5 bill, particularly in Queensland. We got the Laguna Keys and all those great resorts in Queensland. Great donation from Japan.
Absolutely.
We were the winners. So PPPs are not measured as a success by how much profit the owners make. It's whether the public gets a service and how much it costs the public for it. So the Cross City Tunnel is the only one that has been a great success for the taxpayers.
Sukato, you've got a connection with the Cross City Tunnel. You have to declare that, don't you?
You were called out on Media Watch, weren't you?
No, excuse me. I personally wasn't called out. It was one of the wonderful people who worked with me who was actually a never a paid member of the party, but can I say trained amongst the ALP. And we're, you know, what
she's
can I say?
She's blaming you, Joe.
But I am. I'm trying to shift the blame. But no, look, listen, I love the Cross City Tunnel.
So do I. It's the best thing ever happened.
Absolutely adore it. And quite frankly, there's a reason that business makes profit on these things, and it's because they take risk. And anyone who makes an investment knows there's a chance they're going to lose it. They're grown-ups. They get the game. If you're in there for the upside, you're there for the downside.
We do have a special guest joining us on the line if you want to whack those headphones on. Sue Cato with you, Stephen Mayne, John Brown. Also joining you now is John Dowd, former Liberal New South Wales Attorney General. John Dowd, good morning. We haven't chatted since the election. How are you?
I'm well. I've just been through the Lane Cove Tunnel, so I've enjoyed your comments about the Cross City. I actually saw another car travelling north in it. It was quite exciting.
Is it empty?
Well, not everyone's going to Parramatta.
How do you travel north in the Lane Cove Tunnel? It goes east-west, as I understand it.
Oh,
Dowd, you've lost your way again.
I tell you what, a hearing of the Mental Health Review Tribunal isn't going to start unless I get there.
Well, that's very true.
Are you on the panel or are you a patient?
You're right,
I love him. He's a good man.
I've learned to be very patient with you.
And, John, I'm actually in the studio with Brownie, so I'll sort that out later for you.
Yeah, look, we should be able to handle that. John Dowd, who would you like to see leading your former party?
The one they elected. I'm a Democrat. I believe in democracy.
Right, but don't you have a personal preference for who might do better for you at an election?
I think they've made the sensible decision at this stage. I think Brendan is more experienced than Malcolm Turnbull at the Straight Politics. Malcolm is a good advocate and a good headline grabber, but at this stage... Brendan and Julie's experience, I think, will serve them well. What's got to be remembered is it's only a 2% swing to return to government, which will mean the opposition will be more effective because they'll be more credible.
John Dowd, name one thing you're looking forward to next year, some topic or some challenge, program you've got on the horizon that you're looking forward to in 2008.
Oh, that's a whole range. I suppose from a personal point of view, it's seeing how the new government's going to operate in terms of funding for humanitarian causes overseas.
Mm.
I do a lot of work for AusCare, and we, with the support of the AusAid under the previous government, have done a lot of work in East Africa and Pakistan. We're going into Sri Lanka, Timor-Leste, and... we hope that there won't be a change in AusAid's priorities.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of people out there Australia can help. The big issue that I've been involved in, however, is ocean nourishment and fishing. We need to make sure that we restore the balance in the waters around our coasts. A lot of the east coast is very much fished out. So that's another interest that I'm in, which also helps with climate change.
That's going to be interesting to watch. John Dowd, thanks for everything you've done for us this year and all the best.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to work with you, and I look forward to watching or listening to you and your future career. And see you, Sue, and see you, John.
See you, Johnny Dowd.
See ya.
John Dowd is the former Liberal New South Wales Attorney General. The ocean enrichment stuff sounds interesting, actually, and that's got to be important. Stephen Mayne and I were talking about this earlier, about finally how everyone sort of got on board with the discussion about climate change and the like. But it's, as we said, it's business that got there first, and it's possibly business that's going to lead the way there too, no?
I think it is, yes. And it's nice to hear a Liberal talking about, you know, foreign aid and climate change. And it's sort of like, you know...
Can I tell you, don't be shocked.
He's a real Democrat. He's a good man, John Dowd.
He's a real Liberal. A small L.
Old-fashioned Liberal,
yeah.
Not many of them left.
No, but they're out there. There are patches of them.
Fay.
There was a threat. And look, there are some of them actually in Parliament. You've got Maurice Payne. You've got Chris Pine. You know, there are a number of them actually out there.
It's going to come out of Victoria. I think New South Wales is a lost cause. The right's got him. 18 of the 21 on the state executive.
He's had a shot at, you know, Ruddy being a Queenslander.
I mean, I think
it's a shot at New South Wales.
He's very parochial.
The greatest failing of the Liberal Party in recent years is the fact that they couldn't get their act together to get rid of the Yemen government after all their incompetence. And that was the biggest no-brainer of a government should go, I think, we've ever seen.
It goes back
and
to
they
the
got
fact,
flogged.
It goes back to the fact that the party has been in extraordinary operational and machine decline around the country for many, many years.
I think we should talk about that a little later as well, because more party liners are joining you at some stage. 17 minutes past 9 on 702 ABC Sydney. But just on a personal note, John Brown, and a listener is tipping me off that perhaps it might be your birthday next week. Is that right?
Wednesday, yes.
The 19th of December, and you'll be 76.
It's a mistake on my birth certificate. I'm actually dyslexic. I'm 57 at the minute.
But I did want to ask you, though, for you this year, on a personal level, has been a bit challenging in terms of the health of some of your family members, I understand.
Well, I've got an elevated view of the public health system because of, well, I've always had it, but this year particularly. One of my grandchildren, a little two-year-old, developed a tumour on the kidney. And the treatment that she got at Westmead, at Royal North Shore, and at Prince of Wales is simply outstanding.
Really?
I mean, really outstanding. And then one of my other daughters-in-law, after four attempts at IVF, eventually became pregnant. At 19 weeks, her cervix split into Prince Alfred in a private ward, stayed there for 20 weeks. 10 weeks, they had the child prematurely. Child beautiful, spent 10 weeks in a Humie crib. When he went home, nurse back there every day of the week, three times a day. I mean, all this for free. Not another country in the world would even think about it.
Did you find...
And yet people bag, no matter who's in power. The cost of the public health system becomes bigger and bigger and bigger as we get older, as operations become more sophisticated. And I think people should stop bagging the health industry, no matter who's in power, and start realising how good it is.
I agree. World's best health system, Australia. Medicare, universal coverage, cheap drugs, pharmaceutical benefit scheme.
Go and
some
see
operational
sicko.
Difficulties, but overall, yeah.
You know. See sicko. You'll see how good we are.
It's 18 minutes past 9 on 702 ABC Sydney. That's a really good story to share with us this morning, John Brown. Stay with us, won't you? We bid farewell to Stephen Mayne, who has been my partner in crime on the radio waves for so many years now. And it's always great to see you, Stephen.
Thanks, Virginia. It's been a pleasure over the last 8 years, and very best of luck with Late Line and everything else.
We'll catch up soon. 19 minutes past 9 on 702.